Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly roundup of Utah news featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. Today on the program, voter groups sue to try to prevent Utah from instituting new congressional maps. Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes is reportedly preparing to run for U.S. Senate against Mitt Romney, and how a change in water law will help the Great Salt Lake. Joining me for this conversation here in the studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Innovation Lab producer and engagement reporter.
You nailed it.
I got it. Sage Miller, and welcome, Sage. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
On the Zoom, we have Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke, and good morning. Thanks for being here as well, Robert. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Roger.
Good morning. Of course. Good morning. A little bit later in the show, we will hear from Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott, so stay tuned for that as well. Listeners, you can join this show with your questions and comments. Call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We'll be paying attention to the Twitter as well. And I want to start with the lawsuit filed yesterday by a group of voting rights advocates challenging Utah's redistricting procedures. Robert Gerke, this was a story that you broke and covered. It has to do with a ballot initiative, the way that the legislature changed it, and ultimately accusations of gerrymandering. Just tell us a little bit about this lawsuit, who filed it, and why.
Yeah, I mean, I think you summarized it well. There's a lot of history to go into, but the groups, the League of Women Voters of Utah and Mormon Women for Ethical Government are the groups that are suing to challenge these redistricting boundaries, saying they were gerrymandered. There are also seven individual plaintiffs from Salt Lake County. As you recall from our previous discussion, Salt Lake County was split into four congressional districts, and these residents live in each of those four districts and say that they are being unfairly disadvantaged by the cracking of Salt Lake County and its communities of interest. And so you can probably hear my dog slurping water in the background. I apologize for that.
It's fine.
So yesterday they filed this lawsuit. The legislature adopted these boundaries back in November, and that was after the Independent Redistricting Commission made its recommendations for four districts that would have, three of which would have been safely Republican, one would have been competitive. All of the independent analysis of the districts that the legislature did adopt said that they would all four be safely Republican seats in the state. And then, you know, the math behind the gerrymandering claims is that about 30% of Utah typically votes for Democrats. And so they, if they should have 30% of the representation or at least one of the four seats. And so this again, the independent commission recommended the three safe Republican districts, the one Democratic district. The independent commission was the product of this Proposition 4 that voters approved back in 2018 after the legislature refused to pass a bill creating an independent commission that wouldn't be driven by political motivations.
Right.
There was a group, Better Boundaries, that put this on the ballot. Voters approved it, just over half voting for it. And it became law. The legislature watered it down to make it purely advisory, that they could do whatever they wanted, and that's what they did. And that's what these groups say is wrong, and they're challenging in state court.
This is the idea of challenging the new maps is not something that's just happening here in the state of Utah. This is a story, creating the commission and then having the commission undone by the legislature, that might be a kind of unique to Utah. I'm not 100% certain about that, but there are suits in other states, is what I'm trying to say, that are challenging new maps. And just to be clear, here in Utah, this isn't about all of the maps, it's just about the congressional maps, correct?
That's correct. They are not challenging the state legislative maps, the House and Senate maps, and then the state school board maps that were drawn by the legislature. And I think, you know, I asked them about that yesterday, and they didn't really want to elaborate or expand on that too much. But I think the problem that they run into there is most of the Democrats in the legislature voted for those maps, whereas the congressional maps didn't get much, if any, Democratic support. So they're just challenging the four seat congressional map. As you mentioned, this is not unique to Utah. It really kind of started a few years ago when North Carolina courts threw out the maps in that state. Since this last round of redistricting, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, there have been 21 states where the maps have been challenged in court. That's for both the congressional and legislative combined. You know, there some of them are just legislative, some are just congressional, but 21 states in total, where they said that there is either a political gerrymander, a racial gerrymander, or some other form of gerrymandering that would invalidate these maps. And the legal claim, and I don't want to get too down in the weeds here, but the legal claim is that everybody has a right to vote, right? So if people are deprived of a meaningful vote, or deprived of the right, in Utah's constitution, it's called the free and fair election clause. If they're deprived of the right to have a free and fair election and a meaningful vote, then that would make it an unconstitutional gerrymander. And in three states, as I mentioned, Alaska, Ohio, and I am now blanking on the other one.
It's in your article. I could pull up. Yeah.
I believe it's North Carolina, but there's also a case pending in Pennsylvania. The courts have struck down the maps that have been drawn. In Alabama, the court struck down the map, but that was stayed by the Supreme Court, so that case is still pending. And I want to, one other point. I mean, this is something that it's not just, you know, in Democratic groups or progressive leaning groups that are doing this, challenging Republican maps. There's also in some states, Republicans challenging Democratic drawn maps, because this is not unique to Utah.
Sure.
This is more a function of political power that these legislators want to make safe districts for the party that they prefer. And that's how we end up with this this problem of skewed districts.
Robert, does the lawsuit itself seek to just, you know, does it seek to implement the maps that the commission drew, or what does it seek to do?
Yeah, I kind of thought that was the direction that they were going to go, but they're seeking to invalidate the maps, and this is kind of a key point, invalidate the maps for the 2024 election. So we would go through this 2022 cycle, because candidates have already filed and are campaigning. We would go through the 2022 cycle with the maps that, as they're drawn now. And then if these groups and these individuals prevail, they would have to draw new maps in time for the 2024 election. And that would be, they said they would be seeking guidance from the court or you know, some court intervention to draw those maps in a more balanced fashion.
Hey, also, Robert, just what, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm curious about what lawmakers say. I mean, I don't know if we got to this earlier on, but lawmakers who discarded the maps drawn by the independent commission, what do they say was behind their, you know, their, well, I guess first off, their watering down of Proposition 4 and yeah. You know, being able to choose not to accept those maps or being able to decline those maps, I guess, and then also discarding the maps that the commission drew once it did draw them. What do lawmakers say was the justification for that?
Well, they say that the Constitution provides state legislatures with the power to draw maps, and it can't, you know, a voter initiative can't undermine that or limit that authority, because it's explicitly given to state legislatures. So they said that Proposition 4 was unconstitutional. They threatened to repeal it entirely or go to court to challenge it. And so they kind of, the Better Boundaries group reluctantly came to the table and negotiated to try to save what they could. Their explanation for the way that, for adopting the maps that they drew stems partly from an exercise of that power, right? But also, they also said that they have had their own priorities. They wanted an urban and rural split. They wanted representation in all four districts that is urban and is rural. And partly you would end up having to split Salt Lake County anyway, because there's too many people in Salt Lake County. So you'd have to split it at least once, in some cases twice. Splitting it four times, you know, again, the plaintiffs allege was a political ploy to what they call crack. You can, when you're trying to gerrymander, you can crack or you can pack. You can pack everybody, all of the minority party into a couple small areas, or you can split the minority party into different areas. And what they've done here is decided to split them. The legislature said they wanted an urban-rural split. They said the maps are defensible and provide balance across the state.
I'll remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to @KCPW. What does legislative leadership say about this new lawsuit, Robert?
Yeah, not much. And that's kind of normal. The groups typically don't comment on litigation, and they don't want to say anything that's going to get them in hot water. The state Senate president, or the state Senate, said yesterday that they feel like they exercised their constitutional authority, fulfilled their constitutional duty, I think is how they said it. Governor Cox was asked about this yesterday. He's not actually named in the lawsuit. Lieutenant Governor Henderson is, because she's the state elections director.
Right.
But he was asked about it yesterday. He said that he does not believe, the question was put to him, so you believe that the maps that you signed into law were not a gerrymander? And he said, correct. And then he quickly clarified that they're not an illegal gerrymander. So that seems to imply that there is some, you know, some gray area between where you can gerrymander a little, but not a lot. And so that was sort of an interesting comment, maybe right. A telling comment.
Right. That there was some decision making possibly being driven by politics is the idea there. Do we just now, you know, actually a couple of things. One is that you pointed out that Senator Derek Kitchen had a bill that aimed to get Prop 4 reinstated, that commission, the Independent Redistricting Commission reinstated. He ran that at just this last legislative session. Did that bill have a chance, Robert?
No, it came out very, very late in the session. I believe it was in the last 4 days of the session. And, you know, coming from a Democrat that late in the session to undo something that the legislature had done just in 2 years, 3 years previously, it was never gonna go anywhere. But I think that, you know, the groups are the litigants in this case, the plaintiffs in this case, are pointing to that as an indication that the legislature has no intention of respecting the will of the voters, in the sense that, you know, the voters approved Prop 4, that the legislature repealed it, and they don't intend to go back to it. So it's sort of a sidelight. One of the interesting stories
sure.
Yesterday I was talking to two of the plaintiffs, Victoria and Malcolm Reed. They live in Mill Creek. Victoria said she woke up one day last month and decided that she goes for a daily walk, right? And she walked through all four districts from her house. She left her house, walked through all four districts, and was back home in 45 minutes because they live near that juncture of the four legislative districts. But she's also, you know, there was a discussion of two people in downtown Salt Lake who live just 400 yards apart, basically. Yeah. But they're in separate districts. One is in a district with voters from St. George. One is with the district with voters from Logan. And the contention is obviously that it easily could have been drawn that these two people were in the same district and they have more in common with each other, more common interests than they do with the voters in St. George or Logan. So, you know, that's sort of the real life face, I guess, on these decisions that are being made by legislatures and why the redistricting matters.
Yeah, I mean, there was the whole, I mean, communities of interest was one of the sort of guiding principles of what the Independent Redistricting Commission was using to draw the maps that they drew, right. As opposed to that rural-urban split. Do we just, I mean, Robert, actually, you know what, you've been playing reporter this whole time, and I'm wondering if I can ask you to put on your columnist hat and just tell us what you think should happen here. I mean, we're waiting for the courts, I guess, to decide whether or not they'll intervene. Do you think they should?
Well, I think there's a good possibility that they will. I think that, you know, we now have districts where the most competitive district is a 24-point Republican advantage. The fourth district, which was in the past the most competitive district, is now a 34-point Republican advantage. So, you know, it's ensured that Democrats in Utah will not have a voice in Congress for the next 10 years. So that means something. As I mentioned, that this is. You're supposed to have a meaningful vote. You're supposed to have a meaningful voice, and you're supposed to have some accountability. And they've undermined all three of those principles. And so I think there's a good possibility that courts will intervene. I think this court intervention is the only way that we're going to, you know, put a check on the power of this legislature when it comes to redistricting. And so and also because, as I mentioned, there have been cases filed in other states that have been successful, that are based on similar, if not identical, language in their state constitutions. A lot of state constitutions are sort of copy and paste jobs, right? So the language is similar, the legal arguments are similar, and so there is a precedent for doing this. So I think it's I'm glad to see it. You know, I wish it would have come a little earlier, so maybe we could get something in place by 2022. So there's not 2 years with districts that may or may not be unconstitutional, or we at least get an answer to it. So, but I'm glad to see it, and I hope it's successful, because I think we need to have some form of proportional representation. It's sort of the cornerstone of democracy, and I think is unfortunate that the legislature doesn't see it that way.
That's Robert Gierke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Robert, thank you for this, both for the reporting and for your analysis. We need to head to a break in the show, our first break, but when we come back, we will turn to a look at a new law that aims to get more water to the Great Salt Lake. We'll try to untangle a little bit of water law at the same time. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune Innovation Lab producer and engagement reporter Sage Miller, and by news columnist Robert Gierke. This is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to @KCPW. The Great Salt Lake has been thrown a lifeline by the legislature. The lake has been suffering because of a lack of water from diminished inflows, especially, and also from drought. Sage Miller, you reported on this, and I should say that the reporting you did was a part of the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, which is this initiative that both the Tribune and KCPW, and for that matter, Utah Public Radio, who's also airing the show, belong to. And I'm wondering if we can actually start there. Can we define what this collaborative is, Sage?
Yeah, I think we're still in the midst of trying to figure out cohesively what exactly this collaborative is, as you know.
Yeah.
So many meetings. so many meetings.
They're great, though.
But yeah, they're like incredibly informative. But I think the goal of the Salt Lake Collaborative is the Great Salt Lake Collaborative is to find solution-based like journalism and initiatives within collaborative with different kinds of organizations to try and figure out how and if we can even save the Great Salt Lake. And if we can't, like, what does life look like beyond that? And being able to kind of look at different different kind of like avenues that different states and different countries have kind of dealt with in terms of the drought or dealing with diminished water resources, and specifically like namesakes like the Great Salt Lake, like Owens Lake in California, right? Kind of, and that's not a great example,
right? Because it has not done so well.
Yeah, but you know, to kind of prevent an Owens Lake from happening to Great Salt Lake.
Yeah, I've got a sort of the mission statement of the group. It's a group of news, education, and media organizations that have come together to better inform and engage the public about the crisis facing the Great Salt Lake and what can be done to make a difference before it's too late. And the question that we want to answer is, during a time of drought, climate change, and major population growth, how can Utah better support this critical body of water? And using solutions journalism, which is journalists are really good at sort of describing a problem often, less good at
figuring out the solution to
it. And so the idea here is to look at potential fixes to the problem and cover those as well. Let's turn to your story. The lifeline that the legislature threw to the lake, which is House Bill 33. This has to do with water law, and helpfully you, during your reporting, spoke to a water lawyer. Maybe lay out the basics for us. What is House Bill 33, and what does it do?
So it's a consensus amongst a lot of people in the water community that this is just like a really cool bill. They're pretty stoked on it. And what it does is make a monumental change to Utah water law that allows the Great Salt Lake to essentially hold water rights. Before this bill, and I will note that the governor hasn't signed it yet, there's no reason why, to my knowledge, there's no reason why he wouldn't, but it's still on his deck. It doesn't have the signature yet. But what this essentially does is allow the Great Salt Lake to hold water rights, because until this point, it wasn't considered a beneficial use of water. So all water right holders had to use all of their water annually, and if they didn't, they were at risk of losing it. So it's like this use it or lose it stipulation in Utah water law. And it said that, you know, they had, like, water rights holders had to use all of their water, and that it couldn't stay in stream and go to the Great Salt Lake because that wasn't a beneficial use. So it changes this idea of what beneficial use means and allows it to allows water law to, like, go to the Great Salt Lake now. It also allows the Great Salt Lake to hold water rights, well, on behalf of, well, the Utah Division of Fire, Forestry, and State Lands would be able to hold water rights on behalf of natural lands like Great Salt Lake.
Wow. And the way that they would hold that water is that, I mean, there's a second part of this, right, which mm-hmm. is that farmers upstream or those who have water rights on the Bear River, for example, or on another, you know, the Jordan or the Weber. Or
any natural land.
Yeah. The second component of this is that they would be able to lease their water to the lake, basically.
Yes.
And okay, go ahead. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty it's very convoluted and very complex. Water law is also pretty archaic. And so this is why it's one of the reasons why it's such a big deal, because it's like it's one of the very first changes to Utah water law in like 14 years. And so what it essentially allows is farmers, I'm just going to use farmers as an example,
sure.
It's going to be the easiest one. So farmers, instead of using all of their water, for example, they can lease it to the Great Salt Lake for a minimum of 1 year and up to 10 years. And after that lease period, it just goes right back to the farmers, goes back to the original water rights holders. But in that moment, they're able to make a decision, essentially, of, okay, it's a bad drought year. It's not going to be a beneficial use of using my water to try and grow wheat, for example. It's probably going to die. I'm not able to harvest the crop. So instead of just wasting all of that water because I have to, because I'm at risk of losing that water to the state if I don't, I can lease it to the Utah Division of Fire, Forestry, and State Lands to the Great Salt Lake. So therefore, farmers are getting, it's like a market incentive, essentially. Farmers are getting money for leasing their water, and the Great Salt Lake benefits because there's water going in stream and flowing down and trying to fill it.
Yeah, and trying to fill it. You spoke with someone who, you know, this water lawyer that I mentioned, Emily Lewis from Clyde Snow,
mm-hmm.
She says that this measure alone won't be enough to save the lake, but that it is a good first step.
Yeah, it's a critical first step, and that's something that Emily Lewis agrees, Representative Joel Ferry, who is the sponsor of the bill, agrees with, and same with Linda Freitas, who is the executive producer of Friends of Great Salt... Director of Friends of Great Salt Lake, and say that, you know, there's a lot that kind of has to change in order to save the Great Salt Lake, but this is a legal avenue to actually get water to the lake, which wasn't available before. So this actually provides a tangible solution to be able to allow the water to hold water. I mean, to allow the lake to hold water rights.
Yeah, So, you know, if you're a farmer, you can let a portion of your water, instead of using it, you can let it go downstream. You don't lose access to that water in the next, you know, go round, I guess. There is Laura Vernon with the Great. She's the Great Salt Lake coordinator for that division, the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. She said that she told you that she was kind of worried about whether farmers would actually lease out their water. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So that's the biggest question mark right now, because it is a drought year, because Utah is dwindling in water resources in general. It's like an asset to water right holders. They don't necessarily want to give it up in this. This law is essentially, it will only work if people are willing to give up their water rights and lease it to the Great Salt Lake. If they don't feel like doing that, then it won't work.
Mm.
And what Laura Vernon was saying was, it's hard. Maybe in a wet year we're gonna get more like momentum on this, but they aren't sure right now. However, Emily Lewis is very confident that the moment this bill is signed by the governor, that she's gonna start getting change applications sliding across her desk. But that doesn't mean that's gonna go to the Great Salt Lake. It could just mean that water rights holders are just shifting where they want to put their water rights,
yeah.
And it could be at in-stream flows.
I guess it's interesting because you mentioned wet years, and I remember that Representative Ferry, who sponsored this legislation, at one point during the Great Salt Lake Summit that was hosted by House Speaker Brad Wilson, said that he actually thought that drought years might be when this happens, when farmers would use this, because farmers wouldn't get much of a crop anyway, so they would say, you know, we'll send our water downstream. Does this all come down to what the price is? Like, how much will farmers get paid? Do we know that yet?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's up to the farmers, right? They can set their own price tag. They can set their own price tag, so they can decide whatever it wants. It's a free market. They essentially just created, like, a free market to lease their water rights for in-stream flows for natural lands.
And the money to pay for that comes from?
So the Great Salt Lake – I know that Speaker Wilson, there was just a Great Salt Lake Trust that was passed, $40 million. And with that bucket of money, they can lease water rights if the opportunity becomes available to them. Mm. And that's going to be – decided with a bunch of different stakeholders that was outlined in the bill. So I don't remember the bill name though.
Yeah, I don't remember it either. But the money is held in a pool. It's managed by various stakeholders, as you said, maybe conservation groups and so on. But then it's leased by them and then held in the Great Salt Lake by the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. It's a very complicated, reworking of old water law. And your article is very clear on it.
Thank you.
It helps explain what it is that we're doing. We're kind of low on time. What else are we missing from the story, Sage? There's a ton, obviously.
I think the biggest thing that we're missing is this is not a new law. Like, a bunch of states in the West have an in-stream flow bill that does exactly this, right? So, for example, the state of Oregon actually has a water law that says lakes can't go below a certain amount. And if they do, we have to pool water resources to keep lakes at that level. Utah doesn't have that law, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a big deal because, like, Utah just doesn't work the way that Oregon does, right? We're very market driven, and so this kind of just did create an incentive for people to let go of their water and give it to the natural lands if they felt like it, especially in a drought year, right? If they're like, man, I'm not going to make any money off of alfalfa, might as well make some money by, like, helping the Great Salt Lake. It gives them that option now. It's a progressive law for Utah, but other Western states go further.
Wow. You brought up alfalfa. That's a cash crop and uses a lot of water. It's something that we've talked about before and we'll continue to talk about, I'm sure, on the show. Robert Gierke, news columnist with the Tribune. Do you have any comment you'd like to offer on this before we head to our underplayed story of the week? Because we have to go there and then on to Brian Schott. But yeah, what's your any comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Sage said put it very well. It isn't going to solve the problem, but it could make a difference. And so, you know, and that's with all of these big problems, whether it's Great Salt Lake or Utah Lake or drought, generally speaking, it's not a silver bullet. It's a bunch of little things. It's things like water metering. It's things like, you know, this in stream flows. And leasing water to the lake. It's conservation measures that we can take on landscaping and so forth. It's going to take all of these things to save these waterways and to maintain enough water for us to continue to grow in the future, because there's no sign of it letting up right now. So it's an important first step, but the problem is not solved, clearly.
Boy, and you wonder about the natural limitations of growth in general. Thank you. I'll mention again that this reporting was done as part of the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, a solutions journalism initiative that partners news, education, and media organizations to help inform people about the plight of the Great Salt Lake and what can be done to make a difference before it's too late. Sage Miller, thank you very much for reporting on this.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. With that, actually, we're going to turn to our final segment of the show, which is the Underplayed Stories of the Week, where we highlight a reporting that maybe you missed. This is before we head to a recorded segment. Robert Gierke, do you got a pick for Underplayed Story?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who grew up in Salt Lake area probably knows the heavy metal shop.
Yeah.
There's a really good story today about how the community is rallying to support the heavy metal shop. It just posted today after the matriarch of the heavy metal shop, as she was called in the story, passed recently.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of one of these, it's Salt Lake institution, you know, like Kilby Court and Ken Sanders Bookstore and places like that,
yeah,
that give the city a lot of character. And I think it's inspiring to see people, coming out to support it because they recognize what it means to Salt Lake.
Yeah, sort of a part of the fabric of the culture. Robert Gierke, great pick for Underplayed Story. Sage Miller, your pick for Underplayed Story, if you've got one.
I do. And yeah, heavy metal shop, namesake, one of the namesakes, right, of Salt Lake. And shout out Pollock Jaswal for reporting on it. And my Underplayed Story of the Week is actually by Peyton Harkins. She did a really phenomenal, and it's troubling, but like phenomenal reporting on an RV fire that happened and kind of outlining the state of homelessness in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And how it's increased like 600% within the past few years, and how there's been little relief for the state, but does a really great job humanizing the story of like looking at the actual impact of individuals affected by the lack of action the state has taken when it comes to preventing homelessness in the beginning.
Mm. Really, really poignant reporting by Peyton Harkins. Check that out. I'm going to, for my part, just quickly, I'll mention Brian Maffley's story on a report that says that the White Mesa uranium mill has become essentially a radioactive waste dump, according to a group that is sounding alarm bells. And Maffley's reporting highlights comments from the nearby Ute Mountain Ute tribe and also from the Navajo tribe, who say, among other things, that they don't think that this kind of facility would ever have been allowed to operate near Salt Lake City or, say, Provo. And it's great reporting. And then also a piece by Stephanie Russell that was on the fact that Hell's Backbone Grill in Boulder, Utah, got named a semifinalist in the Best Restaurant category for the James Beard Awards. First time that a Utah restaurant has ever received that honor. Check all of that out and everything else that we've been covering at sltrib.com. Sage Miller and Robert Gerke, thank you for spending some of your morning with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Roger. Have a
thank
good weekend.
Thank you.
Yeah, you as well. There's still more to come on Behind the Headlines. Stay with us. After a break, we'll turn to my conversation with Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. And now on the show, we will turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott. We kick things off talking about the analysis of former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman Jr., on the invasion of Ukraine. Take a listen. Brian Schott, thank you very much for being here today on the show. We appreciate
it. Sure.
A couple of pieces of political news that I want to get to, and also of war news that I want to talk to you about. Let's dive into Ukraine, actually, to start with.
Sure.
Some analysis by John Huntsman Jr. on Vladimir Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Huntsman is the former ambassador to both Russia and China. I think a number of us have been wondering about his opinion here, but I, for one, haven't been able to track him down. So what is his assessment, and where is he making it, Brian?
Well, he spoke last week to the Economic Club of Minnesota. They were giving him an award. And I was surprised that he spoke, because I had communicated with him prior to the invasion, asking if he wanted to talk. And he has a new position on an advisory board with the Pentagon. So he declined comment, but he was very, very candid in this speech that they ended up posting a video of online. And he thinks that this is going to be Putin's downfall. The quote was, he's done, the Putin era is over. He thinks that the economic sanctions are going to lead to the fall of his government, or at least him being deposed. But he was very, very careful. And he said he's very worried about what Putin would do in the meantime, because he was, quote, a master of escalation. And I think we've seen that there's really no place that Putin hasn't been willing to go in the past. So he was very, very worried about that.
You know, and it's not just your average citizen making this case. It's somebody who has a lot of diplomatic experience, a lot of history with Russia. And so I guess it's something, you know, advice that we ought to heed. Mm-hmm. But that's the last word from Huntsman, I assume, because of this new position that you described on the.
I don't know. You know, I've reached out to him. He did publish an op-ed prior to the invasion in The Hill, which was interesting. So, you know, I'm still trying to get a hold of him to see what he has to say about that. You know, and it's noteworthy not only because he was the ambassador to Russia from 2017 to 2019, but he talks about what it's like in Putin's office. You know, he said there's a gigantic painting of Peter the Great, who was a person very much involved in building the Russian Empire. And he says Putin sees himself in that same manner, as someone who romanticizes and dreams for the day of the Russian Empire, not the Soviet Empire, but the Russian Empire that was prior to the Soviet Empire. And so that's one of the reasons why he, I think, has some very good insight into the leader of Russia and where we may be headed here.
Well, speaking of assessments of war, of the situation in Ukraine, you spoke with Alexander Vindman, a retired Army lieutenant colonel and former National Security Council staffer. And, you know, Brian, for people who vaguely remember the name, remind us why it's familiar. It's a backstory that ties into a name that we've been hearing a lot in the news lately, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Well, Alexander Vindman was the person who alerted everyone, Congress, blew the whistle on the phone call, that infamous phone call that led to former President Donald Trump's first impeachment. I want you to do us a favor, though, call, the so-called perfect phone call that the president was on, in which he attempted to extort the newly installed president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, into launching an investigation into Joe Biden in exchange for military aid. It's interesting because you can draw a direct line from that incident to where we are right now, because the very weapons that Ukraine was using to defend themselves in the early days of the invasion are the ones that former President Trump tried to withhold. And I don't think a lot of Americans really made that connection at the time, which is one of the reasons why I reached out to him to talk to him about that. Not only that, but because of what happened through impeachment. And I posted a video in my article of his exchange with Representative Chris Stewart. And he was not kind in his assessment of both Stewart and Senator Mike Lee, who were big defenders of Trump, not only during that, but throughout his presidency. And he said the inability, the failure to hold Trump accountable for that offense, and then the inspiring the insurrection and attempt to try to retain power, said all of that were things that helped embolden Putin, you know, and sort of an indirect thing. But he said in my conversation with him that both Stewart and Lee do bear some responsibility for being apologists for Trump, defending Trump, because that showed Putin that he could pretty much do anything he wanted.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of talk about being strong on Putin right now. And where was that? And anyway, that's just all a side note that I will leave to the side.
And that's another thing that Vindman said. You know, he said there Trump gave Putin everything he wanted. There was no reason for him to invade Ukraine during the Trump presidency because, you know, he was getting everything he wanted. He was emboldened. He had Mike Lee talking to him. Mike Lee made a trip to Russia in 2019, and he spoke about lifting sanctions there. Now there's some discrepancy about whether he brought it up or, but it clearly is something the Russians wanted to talk to him about. He went over there to discuss religious freedom and religious liberty, but it did come up. He's on the record as saying it came up. Now, you know, there's some dispute about how much of a role he had in that, but again, the whole thesis of Vindman's argument is that Lee and Stewart do bear some responsibility, as do the rest of the Republican Party, who defended Trump, would not hold him accountable for what he did in 2019, and then again in 2020, in 2021, in January, when his supporters ransacked the Capitol and everything in between.
Yeah, do Lee and Stewart respond to what Vindman said?
Stewart did not respond to me. Lee called the allegations outrageous and disputed them and talked about how he was not emboldening Putin, which you would expect him to say. But Stewart did not respond to me. He did respond to other media calling the article outrageous as well. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that it's a kind of inflammatory statement that politicians are better off not responding to and hoping it gets pushed off to the side in the never-ending flow of news, which is what happens.
Yeah. Hey, quickly on Vindman, I want to get to politics really quickly in a second, but on, you know, did Vindman, he is Ukrainian-American. This is area of the world is kind of his focus, or was when he was, you know, working in national security. Did he talk about sort of threats of escalation, where we might head?
He was one of the few people who was warning that this was going to happen, that Putin was going to do this. You had analysts all across the West, even with a massive military buildup on the Ukrainian border, saying that this was not going to happen. And he was like, no, this is absolutely what's going to happen. Putin is going to invade and we need to be ready. So now he is talking about the need to give Ukraine as much aid as possible to help them fend this off. So he's been pretty clear-eyed about the whole thing. It's easy to dismiss what he said because after he left service. He was forced out. He was reassigned when he was with the National Security Council, reassigned after the impeachment episode, and then retired from the Army. He has been very, very partisan since then. So it's easy to dismiss what he has had to say because of that. And I suspect that that's where a lot of people are going with this. But he's been right up until this point. He's been extremely clear-eyed about where this is going, or at least the steps leading up to it. Now, where it's going to go, who knows? But at least he is a voice that deserves at least some consideration, regardless of whether or not you think he's being too much of a partisan hack.
Politics, two stories. One is that Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes is reportedly considering a Senate run. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in 2024, you know, usually I've got my pulse on what is happening, what people are thinking, but I did not see this coming because it's not on my radar. We haven't had the 2022 elections yet. But Sean Reyes, it looks like he is going to launch a bid for U.S. Senate for in 2024. That's a seat currently held by Senator Mitt Romney. And he may announce it as soon as May. So he'll be campaigning for this seat for almost 2.5 years if he decides to do that. You know, that's highly unusual. Some other names that have popped up surrounding this seat. You know, there's a thought that former Representative Jason Chaffetz is interested in running. I have heard House Speaker Brad Wilson's name come up. Ali Isom, who's currently running for Senate right now, there's a thought that she would take another run at it in 2 years if she does not succeed this time around. But Reyes's name had not come up, and Politico reported this out quite well, saying that he has met with former President Trump twice. In the late stages of 2020, and both times Trump encouraged him to challenge Romney. And I don't know if that encouragement, whether it's about Reyes's political acumen or whether it's just Trump looking for someone to take out one of his rivals, which we know that he likes to do. Interestingly, I don't think Mitt Romney and his people could have been more dismissive of this idea. It was shocking when I saw the quote from Mitt Romney that was made to Politico saying, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but if I were to run again, the best news that I could get is that my opponent is Sean Reyes. That's a burn. That is a big burn. And then someone who has been Matt Waldrop, who used to be Romney's chief of staff, longtime loyalist with Romney. Shortly after that, he basically said that Sean Reyes, this is just the evidence of what happens when you're drinking your own Kool-Aid, you know, so.
Reyes obviously hasn't, you know, confirmed or denied whether or not he's seeking.
No, I spoke to people close to him. And again, they're not confirming or denying, but, you know, this story's out there for a reason, right? And I don't know if it's a trial balloon. It's a pretty damn big trial balloon, if that's what it is. But I think he's going to run. And I don't understand the timing of that, unless he's trying to scare off other opponents, unless he's trying to raise money. It was shocking, to say the least.
It's a long time, and lots can happen in 2 years. Brian, the other politics story that I wanted to get to, the, you know, in the political realm, the choice before Democrats, you know, tell us about this. This is also about a Senate race. It has to do with an independent candidate and a Democratic candidate. Yeah, fill us in.
So as my colleague Robert Gerke reported a couple of months ago, that there's an effort for Democrats. Specifically, it's being led by Jenny Wilson and Ben McAdams to clear the field and not nominate anyone at convention in order to set up a one-on-one between Mike Lee and Evan McMullen in independent. And it's highly unusual. It's not unheard of, but it's highly unusual. As I reported, they tried this in Kansas in 2014, where the Democratic nominee got out of the way for he pulled out of the race to clear the way for an independent businessman to try and knock off Senator Pat Roberts in Kansas. It didn't work. The margin was about 10.6 points, but it was a hell of a lot closer than previous contests where the Republicans had won that seat the nine previous contests by an average of 37 points. So it got closer. And that's the calculus that's happening right here, because Utah has not elected a Democratic senator in 50 years. Literally the last one was 1972. That was Frank Moss. That was the last time a Democrat won a U.S. Senate race from this state. It's not going to happen this year. So it's a cynical calculation where McAdams and Wilson are saying, I would much rather get rid of Mike Lee and put someone in that seat who I don't agree with politically, who does not align with all of my values, but is not an obstructionist like Lee, is someone who they feel that they could work with to solve problems. So that's the calculus that they're trying to put forward. The problem is Cale Weston. He's the only Democrat who filed for the race. And so he is the presumptive nominee. Now, usually at a convention, they nominate a solo person via acclamation. That's not going to happen this time. There's going to be a challenge, and people are going to say not to nominate anyone. We'll see what happens in that floor fight. And Brian, it's probably going to leave. Yeah.
Yeah. How are the Democrats? I mean, how is the rest of the Democratic Party responding to the idea that they don't run a candidate? I mean, are they mad at Wilson and at McAdams for this? Are they sort of seeing the logic?
Okay. So, you know, a lot of the people who are very, I would say the Democratic base, which is much further to the left than the rest of the Democratic Party. And let's look at this at least realistically. There are not enough Democrats to knock off Mike Lee. Not going to happen. Even if you throw in independents who lean Democratic, there's not enough of them to knock off Mike Lee. Even if you throw in Republicans who might be uncomfortable with Mike Lee, there's not enough of them. What they need to do, at least this is the calculation, is if you can get Democrats on board, you can get independent-leaning Democrats. If you get independent or Republican-leaning independents as well and throw that into the mix, that might be enough to knock Mike Lee out, right? So it's still a long shot. Mike Lee is still the favorite no matter what happens. I know he's got a primary. So it's all going to play out on Tuesday of next week with the Democratic caucuses, because that's who they're going to elect who goes to convention. All Cale Weston needs to get is 50 plus one, but all the other side needs to get is 50 plus one. So this is going to be a huge fight on the floor. And for the first time in a long time, it's kind of a hot ticket to go to the convention, because most of the time Democrats are an also ran. You're just putting up a sacrificial lamb.
It is drama. Yeah. Some drama. And you know, either of the candidates, I mean, be it Cale Weston, who was a former State Department official in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and then Evan McMullen on the independent side was a CIA officer. Stark differences from Mike Lee, you know. Well, anyway, I don't know what I'm saying, Brian. That's really
McAdams said to me, you know, look, he's not going to vote the way that I want all the time. And that's clear. I mean, Evan McMullen is not a Democrat. But the calculation is you're not going to get a Democrat. I'm sure Cale Weston is a very nice person, but he did worse against Chris Stewart than Shireen Gorbani did. That's not really the resume that's going to catch fire with the electorate here in the state. If it's Cale Weston versus Mike Lee, I've seen this movie. I know how it ends. What's going to happen is Mike Lee can hide from him the entire campaign. He'll run a few TV ads where he talks about his love of the Constitution and all that stuff. You'll see those ads. You'll see one debate between the two of them. Cale Weston will do a good job, but it'll be too late, right? That's how this movie ends. If you put Evan McMullen in the race, McMullen has a big enough of a following. He's got a big enough of a platform right now, and he's got support nationally that Lee's not going to be able to hide from him. Lee will have to campaign.
Last thing we haven't talked about is, sure, is money. I guess that, you know, if Cale Weston gets out of the race, or if Cale Weston stays in the race, McMullen, does he drop out, I'm assuming, because he won't get the Democratic money?
If Cale Weston stays in the race, I think you're looking at another Mike Lee win, because that was, so I spoke with Reed Galen, who lives in Park City, one of the founders of the Lincoln Project, and he said, if you give Democrats an excuse to not vote for Evan McMullen, they will not, right? But if there's no Democrat, they don't have an excuse, and they're going to have to make that choice, right? Because it's really hard to say, I'm going to vote for a Republican against a Republican. I mean, it's literally the lesser of two evils for Democrats as they make this calculation. So I think it would split the vote. I think it would also hurt McMullen's efforts to raise money. Lee's going to have a bunch of money, not only on his side, but outside groups, specifically Club for Growth. They've told me that they are willing to spend whatever it takes to help Lee through a Republican primary. I don't think they saw an independent challenge coming, but I'm guessing they will come in big. I've heard a number somewhere around $20 million in support for Mike Lee. That's a lot of money coming in, and it's going to be really hard, especially if McMullen is trying to fend off Cale Weston and attack Mike Lee at the same time. You know, the math just does not work at that point.
It's fascinating. Brian Schott, thank you very much for spending the time with us on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Again, that's Brian Schott with the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find his reporting at sltrib.com. And that does it for our show today. You can find podcasts over at kcpw.org or through various podcast apps. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Join us again soon.